Hey, hi, I'm Bonnie. Welcome to this podcast, Make Joy Normal, where we chat about homeschooling and family life. With my co-hosts, Elizabeth and Christina, we address your questions and topics in a way that can create more joy in our lives. Please submit any questions you have by email or voice message in the links in the show notes. If you found this episode valuable, please share it with a friend, like, or leave us a review. That's how we get the word out. Thanks for trying to make joy normal in your own life. Okay, last run here, people. And I have gotten some really lovely feedback from doing this little audiobook series. So I appreciate all of those of you who've contacted me and said that you have been enjoying this. And this will be our last component here. Chapter 7, Be Merciful and Just. The difference between mercy and justice should be easy to articulate. Justice means to give others what we owe them, whereas mercy means to give others more than we owe them. Our sense of God's mercy should overwhelm us. Nothing we can do is ever beyond His mercy to forgive. The length and depth of our neglect toward our Creator will never turn Him away from us. No matter how disordered our lives or how unkindly we treat our neighbors, remember, our spouse and children are our first responsibility as neighbors. God will always forgive us in His infinite mercy. We are called to be merciful as our Father in heaven is merciful. In the Sermon on the Mount, Christ proclaimed that we are blessed and will obtain mercy when we are merciful ourselves. See Matthew 5:7. It can appear that the virtues of justice and mercy are contradictory, but in reality, these two virtues are particular aspects of charity that extend to the relationships of individuals. Justice consists of giving God and neighbor their due. Mercy compels us to exercise compassion and, when possible, to alleviate the sorrow of others. There's some beautiful imagery in that. Exercising compassion and, when possible, alleviating the sorrow of our children. The virtue of mercy can be exercised both physically and spiritually. The Church distinguishes works of mercy as corporal and spiritual. The Church has provided us with a list of corporal and spiritual works of mercy as a foundation for being in relationship with others. How we treat others is how we treat Christ. Whatsoever you do to the least of these, so you do unto me. See Matthew 25. If we have no idea how to treat others, the corporal and spiritual works of mercy are a pretty convenient checklist. Peruse the list and imagine a world where we all did these works for each other on a regular basis. The corporal works of mercy are to feed the hungry, to give drink to the thirsty, to clothe the naked, to harbor the harborless, to visit the sick, to ransom the captive, to bury the dead. The spiritual works of mercy, to instruct the ignorant, to counsel the doubtful, to admonish sinners, to bear wrongs patiently, to forgive offenses willingly, to comfort the afflicted, to pray for the living and the dead. Most parents at first glance will note that most of the corporal works of mercy are things we do daily, sometimes many times daily. The spiritual works of mercy are more subtle in how they enter our routine dealings with our children. I would like to point out two of them that are often overlooked because of our pride, our annoyance, and our children's behavior, and our aversion to how they treat us. Despite our natural reactions, these following two works of mercy are really the substance of caring for our children with dignity. 1. To bear wrongs patiently. It should go without saying that our children wrong us. We also wrong them when we're in bad moods and when we overreact. There is a beautiful reciprocity in learning to bear wrongs patiently. As we obey the teaching to bear wrongs patiently, we grow in patience, understanding, and humility. Then our children learn to bear wrongs patiently, in their turn, growing in patience, understanding, and humility. And 2, to forgive offenses willingly. Forgive and forgive and forgive. We learn to forgive by example. Our children learn to be forgiving from our ability to forgive. They also learn the unfathomable forgiveness of a loving God. So how forgiving do we need to be? Well, we have a good answer in the gospel. For where there are two or three gathered together in my name, there I am in the midst of them. Then came Peter unto him and said, Lord, how often shall my brother offend against me, and I forgive him? Till 7 times? Jesus saith to him, I say not to thee till seven times, but till 70 times seven times. Matthew 18:20-22. Mercy does not condone sin, but forgives sin in charity. To forgive does not mean to condone behavior. We simply can't misunderstand this fact. To be merciful or to forgive in charity is what we are called to do. Hurtful behavior, disobedience, or lack of cooperation are unacceptable, and we must guide our children. To condone undesirable behavior would mean to sanction it by disregarding it altogether or pretend it didn't happen. Not punishing does not mean not guiding them. When they wrong us, we are called to forgive, accept what has happened, and guide them to do better. We do not condone the wrong, but forgive their sins in charity. Mercy flows from love, because when we truly love someone for their own sake, we forget their injuries to us and we think only of what will be good for them. Living the Truth in Love by Benedict Ashley. Mercy teaches mercy. The merciful experience mercy. And a quote from Pope John Paul II. In reciprocal relationships between persons, merciful love is never a unilateral act or process. In reality, the one who gives is also a beneficiary. In any case, he too can easily find himself in the position of the one who receives, who obtains a benefit, who experiences merciful love. He too can find himself the object of mercy. Pope John Paul II, Dives in Misericordia. Mercy and justice work together for the good of all our relationships. The Catechism of the Catholic Church, 1807, defines justice in this way. Justice is the moral virtue that consists in the constant and firm will to give their due to God and neighbor. Justice toward God is called the virtue of religion. Justice towards men disposes one to respect the rights of each and to establish in human relationships the harmony that promotes equity with regards to persons and to the common good. The virtue of justice ideally moves us to work towards the assurance that all receive the respect and dignity that is due to each human being. Justice is not a payment due for sin. We act justly when we first consider the dignity of the other. Justice seeks truth and goodness, dignity for all, not retribution. Justice is often understood as handling out punishment suitable to the crime or infraction in our actions. An accurate understanding of justice is tantamount to acting justly. What is their due in punishment is a very different question than what is their due in dignity. Justice focuses on the other, on relationships with God, individuals and society, our communities and countries. Well-ordered justice asks, what do I owe the other, God, individual, society, and not, what does this person deserve in punishment for their actions? A right view of justice is not compatible with the idea of consequence and rewards. An action needn't deserve a prize. A person, however, deserves the dignity due to them. Another quote from Pope St. John Paul II, Dives in Misericordia. The equality brought by justice is limited to the realm of objective and extrinsic goods, while love and mercy bring it about that people meet one another in that value which is man himself, with the dignity that is proper to him. Succinctly paraphrasing Pope John Paul II's beautiful thoughts on mercy and justice, the adult catechesis program from School of Faith, www.schooloffaith.com, offers this simple thought on mercy and justice. Actually, the difference is easy to articulate. Justice means to give others what we owe them, whereas mercy means to give others more than we owe them. Merciful love is supremely indispensable between those who are closest to one another, between husbands and wives, between parents and children, between friends, and it is indispensable in education and in pastoral work. Also from Dives in Misericordia. How trifling the offenses our children make towards us compared with our offenses toward God. And yet, he is infinitely merciful towards us. Our gratitude to him for his tender mercy and justice and love towards us should compel us towards greater mercy and justice towards our children. Mercy and justice are the model of perfection and what God desires for us. So we move closer to God by conforming our will to His in practicing these virtues. Mercy and justice must be understood in their proper context. We are truly just when we are first merciful. To reiterate this chapter, things to remember about mercy and justice. 1. We are called repeatedly to practice the virtues of mercy and justice. 2. Mercy is the virtue that requires us to act with compassion and to try to alleviate the sorrow of others. Justice requires that we work towards each person receiving what is due to them, primarily their inalienable rights, ensuring human dignity. 3. Mercy does not condone negative behavior, but forgives, guides, and moves on. 4. Performing the corporal and spiritual works of mercy should be a regular part of family life. 5. We must particularly note that we are to bear wrongs patiently and to forgive offenses willingly. 6. To flourish, our children require love, experienced through spoken forgiveness and gentle guidance. 7. Practicing mercy results in an outpouring of love and generosity of spirit. Chapter 8. The Theology of the Body and Dignity in Relationships. The Church has given us extraordinary language to reflect on and to better cultivate our human relationships. It is through this language that we can express precisely what the Church wants of us as human beings in relationship with each other. That language is coherent and accessible in Pope St. John Paul II's Theology of the Body. From 1979 until 1984, Pope John Paul II carried a theme through more than 100 Wednesday audiences in St. Peter's Square. In these talks, he thoroughly examined the dignity of the human person, relationships, and the divine meaning of the body and human sexuality. Later, these talks were published as the work we know as Theology of the Body. The Catholic Church teaches that, as creatures made in the image and likeness of God, we are made for love and to love. We have a vocation of love. Recognizing this vocation colors all that we do as human beings. Pope St. John Paul II's clarity in the theology of the body has formed our view and promoted conversation about personhood and dignity. When we hear theology of the body, we usually think of the Church's teaching on contraception, natural family planning, and chastity. However, the theology of the body illustrates so much more than its profound teaching on fertility and purity. It also explores sweeping questions such as the purpose of our life on earth and what it means to be made in the image of God, the purpose of our body, and the gift of ourselves to others. Most importantly, for our work as parents, theology of the body shows us how the vocation of love is made manifest through the body we have been given. Our bodies were designed for the purpose of living out the Christian life. It is through our body and how we act with it that we work out our salvation. The physical part makes evident the spiritual part of the body. The body, he says, reveals God's love for man. Through Christ, God's love is revealed. Through our own bodies, God's love is revealed. Our spiritual, eternal reality is revealed in our bodies. Through our bodies. Doesn't that blow your mind? It's an indicator of the importance of the language and discussion of the theology of the body as it pertains to our regular life. In the begetting and raising of children, the continuation of the language and discussion of theology of the body is fundamental to understanding and, perhaps the most important point, remembering the most appropriate way to respond to and interact with our children. Most of us as busy parents are not inclined to read dense theological books or articles. Fortunately, the Catechism of the Catholic Church is one of the best places we can form ourselves in the language of the Church, and it is accessible. We don't need to read the entire catechism during these busy years, but we can read sections on marriage and children to prepare us best for what we're dealing with presently. The Catechism of the Catholic Church lists self-mastery as one of the preconditions for all true freedom. Spiritual practices of self-mastery are one of the keys to growing in holiness. We learn to master our bodies and not to be led by our appetites and passions. We learn how to live with interrupted sleep. We learn to master our reactions. The juice on the floor, the toys left out, the sassy reply, they are all one and the same thing. They are offenses. They are also opportunities to grow in holiness. Our kind and patient bearing of offenses day in and day out is simply self-mastery of our bodies, usually the mouth part of our bodies. We are not required to put up with everything our children dish out to us. That would not be good formation for them, and therefore not an act of charity. We are, however, required to bear the offenses with kindness and patience. This is our vocation of love. Bearing with one another and forgiving one another, if any have a complaint against the other, even as the Lord hath forgiven you, so do you also. Colossians 3:13. Patient endurance is the perfection of charity. St. Ambrose. The Catechism indicates the vocation of love again in this passage. Parents have the first responsibility for the education of their children. They bear witness to that responsibility by creating a home where tenderness, forgiveness, respect, fidelity, and disinterested service are the rule. We educate our children with all of our actions. Most of the education they receive in the home is passive. Our children are observing how we relate, solve problems, and live out our life, and live out our faith. We must serve our families, even lay down our lives for them, without getting worked up. We must serve without an interest in ourselves. That is authentic and complete gift of self. The teachings of the Church reveal that conjugal love, the union of man and woman in its proper context, is both unitive and procreative. Intimacy is unitive when it is an authentic and complete self-gift. When physical love is a sincere gift of self, it brings a man and woman closer to each other and also closer to God. Physical union between a man and a woman is procreative. A complete giving of oneself means not holding back anything, including fertility. That complete self-gift allows God, the author of life, to render the union fruitful. Procreativity, creating life with God and for God, bestows fruitfulness on relationship. Fertility and openness to life in conjugal love are life-giving. A couple that chooses the path that is unitive and procreative adds to the life of the Church. They and the Church are blessed and prosper. This vivid and exceptional language of the Church also provides a meaningful picture that indicates how we ought to respond to our children when making disciplinary decisions. Interactions with our children, our discipleship of them, must also be unitive and procreative. It must unite us, bringing parents closer to their children and closer to God. Our discipleship must be procreative. It must bear fruit. It must build up the kingdom within our families, extend to our communities, and ultimately build up the culture of life. In seeking a unitive and procreative approach to raising our children, we must consider the part our body plays. How we use it to discipline and interact with others encompasses how we speak, how we listen, how we react, see, feel, and touch. Our human senses and feelings are part of the body, requiring mastery of ourselves. Our reactions to others are part of that mastery. In responding to the other, we must first understand their inherent dignity. And then we can ask, do our responses reveal this dignity to them? Do we see Christ in them when we mete out punishment or rewards? Here are some further questions we can ask in order to determine whether a disciplinary action is well-ordered and Christ-centered. 1. Is this action I'm about to take, this directive or example I'm about to give, unitive? In other words, does it bring me and my child closer to each other and closer to God? 2. Am I revealing the nature of God to my little one? 3. Are my words procreative in the sense of bearing fruit now? 4. Will they bear fruit in the future? 5. Are they pleasing to God? Do they benefit Him and my family by building up the body of Christ? The language of the unitive and procreative aspects of conjugal love provide rich imagery for viewing all relationships, and most especially those with our children. To consider whether the decisions made in family life bring us closer to each other and closer to God is stirring. To ponder that how I speak to my children may or may not bear fruit, may or may not bless, gives me an image that sustains me in moments of confusion, anger, frustration, or despair over children's behavior. Our ideas of what success is in the middle of the myriad crises of child rearing should not be whether the child has done what we've asked them to do. True success means that our response is to our child imitate the love of Christ. We are faithful when we love our neighbors as ourselves. Success is faithfulness, not productivity. Success is in action, not outcome. In doing our utmost to carry out our daily duties, we must, for the rest, abandon ourselves to divine providence, and that with the most childlike confidence. And if we are really striving to be faithful in little things, in the practice of humility, gentleness, and patience, in the daily routine of our lives, God on his part will give us grace to be faithful in greater and more difficult things. Car je l'arrange, providence. The above quotation illuminates well the idea of practice makes perfect. When we take the opportunity to develop these skills in small ways, we are so much better prepared to handle our frustrations, emotions, and difficulties in more challenging circumstances. And on the other side of that idea, when we see our children practice acts of charity or improve in self-control, we must rejoice at their growth in their faithfulness in little things. So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets, Matthew 7:12. For the entire law is fulfilled in keeping this one commandment, love your neighbor as yourself, Galatians 5:14. Love does no harm to a neighbor, therefore love is the fulfillment of the law, Romans 13:10. As these examples show, the scriptures give us a wealth of encouragement for striving to love more perfectly. Our children need to be our first consideration of other or neighbor. They are our children, after all. We must love them as ourselves. We must do them no harm. Tenderness toward our children is what keeps them soft and receptive to us and in turn to the Father. Kindness and compassion will ensure ongoing conversion. St. Thomas Aquinas said that if you want to convert somebody, take him by the hand and guide him. So we must do with our children, using every part of our physical nature. Our hands, our face, and our voice are all part of the body created in the image and likeness of God, and they must enflesh his love. Nourishing children with a sense of the presence of God in their lives and developing our attachment with them begins most effectively with the care we choose when they are infants. We should respond to their needs with tenderness. Ideally, babies receive nurturing through close physical proximity at their mother's breast and in the arms of their parents. Breastfeeding and Catholic Motherhood by Sheila Kipley is a short and excellent resource for understanding this ideal of closeness. The mothering aspect presented through the text reflects the nurturing capacity of our physical selves as found in theology of the body. A quote from Pope St. John Paul II. The body in it alone is capable of making visible what is invisible, the spiritual and the divine. It was created to transfer into the visible reality of the world the mystery hidden since time immemorial in God and thus be a sign of it. We live in a world that grossly distorts the dignity of the human person. Raising families gives us the occasion to develop young people with a deep understanding of the dignity of others. We do this by providing homes where the dignity of the human person, that includes our children, is evident. If children experience such an atmosphere from a young age, they will much better understand the theology and philosophy of human dignity when they get older. We can use the theology of the body to better understand the dignity of the human person. The eloquent and specific language of the Church deepens our understanding of all relationships and of the dignity of all people. With a deeper understanding, we can act more effectively to treat others with dignity and to guard our love. When we guard love, we do not put walls around it, but we live and proclaim love as God intended it to be, pure, chaste, fruitful, faithful to God, our spouses, and our children. We guard love from worldliness and disorder with our choices and our voices, what we do and what we say. A perfect love comes down to us from the Father. He is love. He is love that does not condemn our faults and shortcomings or our mistakes and doubts. He is a love that shows us when we are loved in spite of all our dumb ideas and disobedience. His love says, come with me and I will show you how to be perfect. We learn that way of perfection from the example of Christ. We can choose love for our spouses and our children. We can show them the way of perfection by following Christ and striving for his perfection, persevering in our failure. If we pursue the way of perfection toward him and instill this determination in our children, we can become conduits or magnets. They will follow because of who we are and what we do and how we love. The future of humanity passes by way of the family, familiaris consortio. These words of St. John Paul II mean that future generations depend upon how we live as a family now. Families are the catalyst to heal the culture. Do not underestimate your own potential as a family to raise up our communities, countries, and civilization by how you choose to love your family. Disciplining them with dignity. As Pope St. John the 23rd said in his encyclical Pacem in Terris, Peace on Earth, the family founded upon marriage freely contracted, one and indissoluble, must be regarded as the natural primary cell of human society. When the family is a strong unit of love, society stands on a strong foundation. Here's a summary of thoughts on dignity. 1. The Church provides us with the language that can help us understand our relationships better. 2. The Church teaches that marital union draws us closer to God and bears fruit. We refer to this marital relationship as being unitive and procreative. 3. Our relationships with our children should be unitive and procreative, drawing us closer to God and one another and bearing good fruit. 4. The language and thought used to discuss the theology of the body is useful in helping us understand and remember how we ought to respond to our children. 5. In choosing love, we follow Christ in the way of perfection. 6. Families that live out their vocation of reflecting God's love will transform our culture. Chapter 9. Why, not how. I don't intend to reinvent the wheel. My goal for this book was to provide a why rather than a how-to. Children aren't likely to rebel if they are treated with dignity. Just a couple of years ago, our own adult kids were having tea with me, and I asked them, "Why didn't you ever rebel? Isn't rebellion considered normal?" They responded with, "Well, what were we going to rebel against?" Our 18-year-old son, while I was waxing about some of the ideas in this book, said, "Discipline is the relationship." I considered tossing the whole book and making the poster, and just making a poster that said, "Discipline is the relationship." But I didn't think of it. Our children can flourish without using punishments and rewards. There are a couple of good books already written on how you can respond to our children when we want alternatives to punishment and rewards. Judy Arnall, author of Discipline Without Distress, has dozens of examples in her book of possible alternatives. Here we can see how the theory plays out in reality. Please be aware that she is not coming from a Catholic perspective. So if there are moral issues, they might be treated quite differently than how she presents them in a Catholic context. Still, I highly recommend this resource as it gives many examples of different ages and stages to draw on. It's an excellent how-to. They are real-life situations that we encounter raising children. There is also the Catholic Attachment Parenting website that lists several valuable resources. Note, however, that not all of these resources are from a Catholic perspective either. I would make one more comment regarding how to follow an example from any of the above resources. Be sincere. Use the suggestions as a jumping-off place and then find your own words in your own way to be able to be completely genuine. Don't just take something word for word and expect it to work. It will be phony if you're just repeating someone else's words instead of speaking to them from your heart. Relationships change with the seasons of babyhood and toddlerhood and beyond. The children's physical needs change, sleep patterns and sleep needs change, as does the nursing relationship. For example, the baby flourishes with almost constant close physical proximity. The 10-year-old can seem to shun hugs and cuddles, but they still need physical contact. Sometimes rubbing their back, messing their hair, or even wrestling with dad can satisfy this very basic need for human contact. The way we walk with our children in discipline also changes, but the premise of walking with our children does not change. Here's a typical scenario. 9-month-old grabs something dangerous. Mom gently removes the item. Baby wails. Mom comforts the baby because she knows he doesn't understand that he could get hurt and also doesn't understand why she's removing the dangerous thing. Baby is sad. Mom responds with love and with cuddles cooing. You really wanted that dangerous thing, but Mama needs to keep you safe, sad baby. We respond with love and we emphasize with their unhappiness, but we still must say no. This is how we recognize their emotions without giving in to their every desire. The tricky part is not getting angry when they're upset by the no in their day. We are okay with our kids crying because we know it's the realm of normal behavior. Even society's okay with it, so we don't have to worry about people staring at us when our kids cry in public. Except occasional intolerant individuals who can't stand children making noise and forget that they were children once too. Still, we all have a point at which we feel the child should know better. So sometimes when the child is 2 or 4 or 6, we tend to start saying things like, you should know better. Or in some cases, you should know better. Or even, you should know better. There are other phrases we all tend to use too often in conjunction with each other. Don't you start that crying. I'll give you something to cry about. Go to your room. I don't want to hear you crying. You're too big to cry about a silly thing like this. What happened? At some point, we unilaterally decided that the child must not be disappointed about this thing, and if he is, he certainly doesn't have the right to show it. Most people see this reaction as the right way to respond. For them, the idea of simply being with the child in his disappointment seems like permissiveness that condones negative behavior. Yet we need to be there for him. We need to come alongside him, acknowledge his upset, and give a little support through it all. It's all most of us really want anyway. Consider how our spouse responds to us when we're upset. What do we really want? Some comfort, usually. That's not permissiveness. That's not condoning negative behavior. That's not positive reinforcement to condition your child to be bad, either. It's simply kindness. To get mad at children, shame them, punish them, only serves to reinforce that they shouldn't feel bad. We can't control how we feel. Feelings must be acknowledged so that we can guide children on how to effectively learn to live with their feelings. If we are constantly berating our children for their feelings, eventually they will attempt to stop feeling. To stop ourselves from feeling, we need to stop ourselves from caring. If there was ever an age where we needed to encourage people to care, this is it. Perhaps the present disturbing apathy is a result of believing that what we feel is bad. We must care. And through our own caring attitudes, our children will naturally learn to care. I feel bad all the time. I cry sometimes when I don't get my way, and it really ticks me off if someone tries to put me in a room or tells me I'm too old to cry or get mad. When someone tells me I don't need to get mad about this or that, I am likely to get more angry. If, on the other hand, someone consoles me, I generally feel better. The only real difference between me and the 2-year-old is that I think my stuff is more important to get upset about. She only lost her plastic dinosaur. I lost my credit card. She only doesn't want to leave her friend's house. I want to get caught up on the laundry. She gets in a bad mood because she's hungry. I get in a bad mood because I'm really, really hungry and I've been taking care of her all morning. It's all the same thing. We want it and we can't have it. Sometimes we see how much a child wants something and we just want to make him happy. It's so important, however, to understand that a healthy relationship doesn't mean you shouldn't say no to your child. In fact, children not getting everything they want and having to learn how to deal with disappointment is vital to their healthy development. Getting anything you want or being constantly buffered from life's big and little hurts and difficulties isn't a realistic preparation for adulthood. A buffered child will find it way more challenging when he has to learn how to deal with the trials that every adult has to face. When one of my daughters was little, she had a hard time with waiting. She also had a hard time with everything else. As soon as she knew something was happening, she would start to wind up. We tried initially to combat this by not telling her anything until it was on the brink of happening. This backfired intensely for a couple of reasons. One, she became suspicious that something was always around the corner, or she was always wound up. Two, we gave her no opportunity to be able to handle waiting. We stunted her ability to grow. We did this primarily because we felt like we couldn't handle her emotions. Also, I thought it wasn't right for such a little person to try to deal with so much emotion. Because soothing her didn't really work, distracting her didn't work, and getting mad at her really didn't work, I started a system of the broken record. I started doing this because it felt like a healthier option than getting mad. So when I said, "We are going to Auntie Monica's later today," she would say. "What? When? I want to leave now. Why can't we go now? Why do we always have to wait? How long until we go? How many more minutes? I don't want to eat my lunch. I want to get in the car and go." Then I would say something like this: "We'll be leaving at 4 o'clock. We'll be in the car for 45 minutes. The ferry leaves at 5 o'clock. It gave me an outlet of sorts to deal with this. For every question, rant, wail, or complaint, I would answer in my monotone, nice voice, "We will be leaving at 4 o'clock. We'll be in the car for 45 minutes. The ferry leaves at 5 o'clock. Doesn't that sound reasonable? Except it didn't work. She continued to be upset. She continued to wind up. I felt ground down by the relentlessness of the whining. Because I wasn't using kindness as a reference point, there was no room for grace. There was no room for her to have an outlet for all those feelings. We all ended up frustrated. So I decided that I needed to learn a new way to grow. Someone suggested to me that I should come alongside her instead. Empathize. My response was this: ew. I thought it would just feed the ranting and wailing. But I tried it. And here's how it went. Me: is it hard to wait? Child: yes, I hate it. Me: I bet you feel like we won't be there for 100 days. Child: yes, it's so stupid. Me: would it be easier to wait if we had a little snuggle? Child: maybe, but I'm still mad at you. Me: come up on my lap. I'm doing all this rushing around getting ready to go, and you're so frustrated. Child: I hate waiting. It's so long. Me: wow, look at all those tears. You must have been really mad to have all those tears. Child: I was mad. I feel better now. Me: well, that's good. Do you want me to help you pack some food? Child: okay, can we pack gummy bears? Me: two each. Child: okay. That worked. It was so worth it. Sometimes it still shocks me that it worked. And it still works. I was shocked and delighted. It showed me how compassion works. We both benefited from kindness and compassion. We both healed our frustration. Compassion is a tough thing to teach somebody. To come alongside someone's frustration, to enter into another's pain, and to truly be compassionate is hard to teach, because the main thing you need is to be sincere. As humans, we are generally pretty sincere about our own frustrations, fear, and our anger and disgust, because we are comfortable with those emotions. We aren't so comfortable when it comes to emotions in others, however, and it's difficult to enter into an aspect of a relationship sincerely that is uncomfortable. It's hard to understand someone else's frustration or sadness or hurt. Because to try to understand it means that we have to consider something that makes us frustrated or sad or causes us pain. And we don't like to suffer. So while it's almost impossible to be sincere and compassionate for the 5-year-old who is upset because the Barbie's hairdo is coming apart, or the 14-year-old who is having a meltdown because she can't find the right dress for a dance, it is possible to find a way to identify with the frustration or the angst they're feeling and be compassionate, not about the issue, but about the frustration. Even if the issue is ridiculous, we still want to show them that we care about their frustration. Frustration, anger, hurt, and fear are universal. We can all identify with those things. It's in identifying with the emotions of another person that we can find a sincere compassion. That's whether it's in marriage or in raising children. It's true of all relationships. It's not the issue that's at stake. It's not about saying the right thing or getting to the bottom of the problem. It's about human relationship. Respect helps with compassion. Consider the person. Remember, we are a pro-life people from conception until natural death and everything in between. We need the ability to see beyond an issue, beyond what the person is upset about, and to see the person and the emotions that burden him. Sadness, fear, anxiety, or anger. To respect a frustrated person is not to judge him and not to comment on or even try to fix the problem. It is merely an acceptance that the person is frustrated about something. It does not matter what the something is at this point. It doesn't matter if it's not an important thing in your eyes. It doesn't matter at all what you feel. It's about what they're feeling. When I had my 6th baby, my youngest son was 3. He was an easygoing, compliant little guy. But this new competition in the house overwhelmed him. He wanted to fit all the Cheerios in his bowl, the whole box, and all the milk. The whole carton. When we explained that all the cereal and all the milk wouldn't fit in his bowl, he broke. He hung his head and wept for all he was worth. He created an impossible situation for a hook to hang his frustrations on. We cuddled him and let him be frustrated. Eventually, he melted into sobs and we all healed. We all had the release that comes with hitting the wall and experiencing the peace of acceptance that comes with tears. To tell a three-year-old that he shouldn't be angry about not being able to fit the entire box of Cheerios into a cereal bowl isn't going to be helpful. That said, to tell him that it is going to fit into his bowl isn't helpful either, nor is it true. Demonstrating that the cereal won't fit into the bowl is going to be disastrous for everybody. None of those answers will help the situation. But there is another option. Wow, you could say, you are really mad about that. Wouldn't it be great if all that cereal did fit in the bowl? You could eat Cheerios all day. You must be pretty hungry. The response? Crying starts and the child may yell at you or call names or pound his fists, but at some point, he will melt into your arms. Then he cries for a while. Usually when the post-crying breathing starts. He also becomes amenable to alternative suggestions or distracting away from the offensive Cheerios. How about I make you some crackers and cheese and then I'll read you a story while you eat them? That's respectful. Now we could crack down on the child here and now and tell him to stop pounding his fist, calling names, etc. But most of the time, once the child has softened into receptivity, he will come to you and apologize of his own accord. That's a victory. That's a very young conscience maturing beautifully. In the event that he doesn't come back to you to repair the hurt, it can be dealt with outside of the crisis circumstances. In grown-up relationships, we experience similar situations. Perhaps a friend wants a raise. She asks her boss refuses. She's frustrated and angry and rants at you about it. To tell her it's stupid to get mad about not getting a raise isn't going to be helpful. That said, telling her she probably didn't deserve a raise probably won't be helpful either. Suggesting many and sundry ways of how she might cut back on her expenses to meet the problem of needing more money is likely to make her pretty mad. Demonstrating how the Cheerios won't fit into the bowl will be disastrous for everybody in this case, too. An adult will respond just as negatively as the child, even if, hopefully, in a more adult fashion. So these still aren't good options. You could, however, say something like, "Man, you must be so ticked. You muster up the courage to approach your boss, and the boss refuses you. Very frustrating. I'm here for you, whatever you need." Her response? Grown-up cries or pounds fists or tells you to shut up or do some other grown-upish form of frustration showing. So you say, "Can I make you some tea? We can talk some more if you need to." That's respectful. People should be treated with dignity, all people. It doesn't matter if they're born yet, if they're 2 or 12 or 20 or 52. We respond well to being treated with tenderness and compassion, with mercy. I am reading again this Advent Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. The year of mercy has just begun. We're preparing for the celebration of the coming of our Savior, and I find myself once again reading this book to my children. I am always struck by the beauty of A Christmas Carol, but a couple of ideas in it were so profound and relevant to the ideas here that I would like to share them. When Marley, Scrooge's flinty old business partner, dead these 7 years, appears to Scrooge as an apparition to entreat him to change his ways, he is encumbered by a chain laden with ledger books, money boxes, and other paraphernalia of his trade. Scrooge notes the chain and comments on it. Marley replies, "It is a ponderous chain." The chain is unwieldy, massive and heavy. It is a chain of his personal idols and of what have now become his regrets. My own ponderous chain could be the moments and intervals in my life when I was unkind. I can't get them back. I can't change them. Yes, I am forgiven, but I pray daily that the damage I might have done in unkindness would not result in the hardening of my children's hearts against me, but especially against God. These are my regrets. I have never, ever regretted being kind. I have never regretted acting with mercy. And old Marley has more words of wisdom for us. Scrooge, in an effort to console himself and soothe the lamentations of Marley's ghost, reminds Marley that he was always a good man of business. "Business!" cried the ghost, wringing his hands again. "Mankind was my business. The common welfare was my business. Charity, mercy, forbearance, and benevolence were all my business." Marley's ghost is poignantly aware that he missed the point. His journey to heaven and how he treated his fellow man mattered more than anything else, and he found out too late. We can simply change the words here to apply to our own lives. My family was my business. As parents, we can employ methods of discipline that will enable our children to grow into the kind of adults we want them to be. We can dispense with tactics of manipulation that lack dignity. To discipline our children in a Christian context requires love. Our reference point is love. Most of us intend to be loving when we have children, to guide and nurture them tenderly so that our children will know the love of God more fully. We just need to learn how to incorporate that intention into disciplining. Even in our attempting to be loving and kind with our children, they watch us grow and so grow with us. When we fail and repent, they grow as they learn from us how to fail and repent. We grow as parents. I'm not the mother I was 10 or 20 years ago. I did foolish things. Lord knows I still do. But my children have always seen me attempt to grow. In all my personal deficiencies and the days where I wept for my inability to live up with my ideals, they watched, forgave, and treated me with dignity when I apologized or admitted my failures. And they have grown up to be more than the adults I ever imagined them to be. They love God, and He works in their lives with grace so prevalent and so plentiful. I cannot ask for more than that. What are we, families? We are children of God. We are seeking the good, the true, and the beautiful. We are the primary cell of society. We are the source of the priesthood and religious life. We are the reason the church exists so she can help us attain heaven. We are those who build up the kingdom of God. We are intimate communities of life and love. We are working out our salvation by living out love in our vocations. And all of this, what we are as families, what we represent in the world, is why Pope St. John Paul II said, "The future passes by way of the family." The world around us cries out for witnesses to strong and loving families. When the world around us sees very imperfect families living out imperfect lives lovingly, a seed of desire is planted. The world notices how you respond to your family, and through that loving response, the world sees how God responds to us, tenderly, firmly, with mercy and justice, with love and kindness. We are all called and capable of being those flagship families who reveal God to the world through love in our families. We are beacons of hope. Our mission is to guard, reveal, and communicate love within the family. The time has come to start a revolution to form our children in Christ-centered love, a revolution of mercy. Be holy. And that, my friends, is the end of my book.